You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Hello. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast. I'm making the most of my time this week, so I'm sat in my car. Football training's on, and I can see the glorious joy of children playing football in the rain while I stay dry. At this week's podcast, I spoke to Helen Bonick. Now, Helen runs the Hole in the Wall website and is probably the national expert on child-parent violence. The reason I wanted to speak to her is I know it's a really hot subject, with many people experiencing it within the adoption and fostering community. And it's one of those taboos that people don't know how to talk about it or don't know who to talk about it to. So it was a really great conversation, and to be honest, listening back to it, now I kind of think, crikey, this was just a start. There's so much to talk about, and I think it's an issue that is really just developing for a lot of families. And there's a limited amount of knowledge held by adoption professionals. And in fact, it was only until I experienced it did I realise it occurred, or even realise that it had a name and it was something that, you know, that many people are experiencing. So this is a bit longer podcast. It's about 40 or 45, 50 minutes. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you very much for downloading. Hello, Helen. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me.
Yeah,
I've seen you on Twitter a few times, and I've seen your name bandied around with the online training and things.
Yeah.
I thought you'd be a good person to speak to. So, Helen, tell me a little bit about how you found yourself in this place and your expertise in this area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's really good to speak to you today. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
I trained as a social worker a long, long time ago and first came across child-parent violence in the 1980s when I was working in Inner London. And I was a very young and naive social worker at that time, I guess. And the team, we worked with this parent who was being attacked by her son, and we really didn't know what to do. We kind of understood it, I suppose, as a family problem, and we referred the family to what would now be CAMHS, and kind of hoped that that would resolve itself, but we didn't really understand what was going on at all properly. And that experience stayed with me for really a long, long time. And
can I ask a question there? You used the expression CPV, child parent violence.
Okay.
Is that even what you called it then?
No, we just thought of it as, I think we probably thought of it as bad behaviour. It was a conduct disorder, something like that. It was extreme, out of control behaviour. We had no sense of that this was a thing. I think this was even before, in the days before we really had a proper understanding of how widespread sexual abuse was. So we're talking a long, long time ago.
Right.
When social work was quite differently organised and understanding was different as well of lots of things, I guess.
Right.
But at that time it was, I guess, easier perhaps to get family therapy type interventions, and that's the route that we thought was most appropriate. We saw it as a family issue about the relationship, and they were seen as the most expert people to deal with it at that time. So that kind of, it troubled me. It troubled me that that might be happening, and it troubled me that we hadn't really been able to reassure mum more than we had been able to. And so many, many years later, I had the opportunity to do some training and decided to make this the subject of my dissertation that I had to do. And I was very lucky then because through personal connections, I was able to connect straight away with Eddie Gallagher, who's one of the experts in Australia and has something like 25 years of experience of working in the field. And so he pointed me in the direction of lots of ideas, lots of reading, lots of people. So I wrote my dissertation. That took a year. And I was so affected by the experience. I interviewed three parents. I interviewed lots of professionals. I read around the subject. And there was hardly anything to read. Mm-hmm. There was very little written about it. There was very little understanding amongst professionals. I was speaking to some professionals who were saying, sure, we come across all this all the time. A few that had got a response. Most that were saying, we don't know what to do. Some that were saying, well, who says this is abuse? You know, it's just this person. What's going on? You haven't heard the whole story. So really mixed bag. And
Was just it a sensation of you almost like exploring into this new world where lots of individuals knew about it, but there's very
few
people?
It was weird because some people knew about it, some people didn't, but it was very closed in. No, it wasn't out there at all. And it was like if you knew about it, you were working it in your tiny little area, but there wasn't lots of dissemination. There wasn't an expectation that it was a nationally recognized thing. So, it really impacted on how I felt about it. And I just couldn't put it down. And I kind of struggled for the next couple of years to find a way to take things forward further. And someone suggested that I should start a website. So that's how Holes in the Wall started.
Right. And what's the website address, just for people?
So you can just type in Holes in the Wall and it will come up. But it's www.holesinthewall.co.uk. And the aim of that was to bring together in one place everything that I could find about child-to-parent violence so that people wouldn't have to go through the same struggle that I'd done. If people were researching, if people needed help, that they could find it more easily, really. That seemed to be something that I could do personally that would make an impact on the need and the situation. And then it kind of grew. So that was in 2011 that I started that. And it's now rather scarily viewed across the world. So there's people have accessed it from over 70 countries.
Right.
I have about 50 hits a day, probably. So it keeps me very busy. And what I have to say is I do all of that in my spare time.
Right.
And so that's my kind of, put my hands up and run away. That I try and keep it up to date. I try and keep it. I know there's some stuff that's out of date at the moment, but it feels quite a weighty responsibility. I'm very conscious that I should be. It's not like a burden, but it feels like, I've taken on this something and I'm not sure how to deal with it almost.
Interesting, because you're talking about 50 hits and I've never seen you promote the website. Very occasionally I'll see maybe a little Twitter link.
Mm-hmm.
50 hits is a lot if you're not pushing it. It's a fairly good hit rate. If you pushed it, you could increase quadruple easily.
It gets advertised at conferences or training events and things like that, and it, I guess, through Twitter a little bit. So, and my own personal experience of child-to-parent violence has then been through friends.
Right.
So when I started talking about what I was doing and how deeply I'd been affected by what I'd read and what I'd heard from people, friends started telling me about their experiences and pointing me towards other friends. And so I started spending time with them and listening to them and trying to think how I could support them a little bit, perhaps. And that seemed to be almost the best thing that people could do, to listen and to be there, really, and to just understand what people were going through. But it really brought home to me the statistics. When we have no statistics because no one's counting it.
Yeah.
But one of the figures that is thrown around is a 10% figure, which is 10% families with adolescents will experience some kind of child-to-parent violence through their in their family.
Can I ask you? Again, it's maybe just a technicality, but really thinking about people who haven't heard the phrase before.
Yeah.
What would you? How would you define child-parent violence?
So, again,
the hardest question yet.
There is no official definition. It's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, we're using a working definition, which was in a book in 2013 from Amanda Holt, which I can't tell you off the top of my head. But we're talking about a pattern of events. So it's not a one-off thing. And we're talking about all different kinds of violence and abuse. So we might be talking about physical, but also emotional, financial, sexual. I'm sure I've forgotten something.
Verbal,
yeah. Thank you.
It was interesting because I was thinking of questions, and that was my start point, really, thinking, where does it start? Because it could be as simple as a slap or a punch, but
Yeah.
So you would look at over time, this developed into something where parents, it generates fear and parents are make changes to their lifestyle to accommodate it. So it's so that's how we get a sense that it's more than just your average teenage stroppiness, which is a pain in the parts, and you yeah. kind of you know that you hope, keep your fingers crossed, and you hope you get through it.
Right.
But this is something which is much more frightening, if you like, and much more persistent, and starts to cause real changes in the way a family is living.
What ages? I've read some definitions that kind of give a predominance adolescent, but what ages are you seeing, and what are people saying to you?
From the people that I know of a family where it was really starting from very young, from key stage one, so five, six. And I know from listening to the adoption community on Twitter that there are families that are experiencing with very young children. Yeah. But I guess it feels like there are two points at which maybe it starts. For some families, it will start when the child is quite young because of a child's previous experiences. And for others, it's less clear cut, or it might start emerging at adolescence, at puberty, when there are lots of other changes happening for a young person.
Yeah.
Which put pressures on and can bring a child into crisis, perhaps. So they're kind of the 13 upwards age group as well. So we're looking at probably a peak age around 13, 16, something like that.
Well, that's really interesting, because I guess the podcast and everything I do is slanted towards adoption, but I'm also,
yeah.
I've been a foster carer, and that's where I work professionally with foster carers. But my perception is younger, and that's maybe totally anecdotal based on my own experience. My first experience of what felt like almost like the beginning of our attrition was three. And I think what confused me was you see toddlers or little ones of slapping or smacking. This was something else. But you know, I'm not going to talk too much about me. I will talk about me, but I'm trying not to. But yeah. I think that often I see in Twitter younger children. So you were saying about that definition.
Well, I think, can I just pick up on that? Because I think that highlights two things for me. And one is that actually around two, three, four, there's sometimes a problem in particularly in getting help as to what is going on here, and really getting a clear sense of. Of parents being told over and over, it's just toddler tantrums, you've got to do this, and actually an understanding that for some families it's not toddler tantrums, and how you unpick that maybe a little bit mirrored in the teenagers when it starts emerging. The other thing that I really want, I suppose I feel I need to emphasise, is that when I speak to training events and conferences, I approach an event feeling reasonably chilled, because I'm fairly confident that I'm one page ahead of everybody else. It's going to be. When I speak to the adoption community, and today, for instance, I'm very conscious that I'm at least two pages behind, if not a whole chapter behind.
Really?
Because I'm learning from you folks all the time.
Right.
And because of when I do my website, it's very much about me learning and trying to encourage other people to take on board new stuff and encourage other people to think about what they're doing. But it's not about me saying, hey guys, I'm the expert, I know all this stuff, here, take it. It's very much an exploration. A lot of the posts that I put up, trying to think things through, trying to ask questions, encourage people to develop their thinking. So I am... When I listen in to conversations on Twitter, I'm learning very much, and I am conscious that when I was reading the comments that were coming out over the weekend, feeling that I haven't got all the answers. I'm very happy to try and help people think things through and help people point towards things, but I don't want to let people down by them assuming I'm something I'm not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned that when I asked if you'd speak to me. You said very clearly, you know, I have no lived experience other than through friends and through your profession. But to my mind, actually, it's really affirming to speak to professionals, someone who's got that professional knowledge, and you hold up a lot, a broad range of knowledge. It's so affirming to speak to someone who's actually goes, yeah, this is a thing. This isn't just you in your house, this attrition that you feel, or the fear that you feel. So actually, that's why I think that you holding that and holding in the position you're in is really important and affirming for adopters and foster carers. Which kind of leads me into, I mean, there's so many questions I wish I'd never asked. Well, I've just set Twitter on fire. So it totally consumed my evening, and I was doing my best to kind of manage that.
I was impressed by your speed of response, I have to say.
Yeah, I was doing it furtively under the table because I was out with Paula, so she was not very impressed. It was okay. We managed that. But what I saw is people desperate, and that's there's almost a tangible sense of people. Tell me what to do. Just help me. Where can I go? Who can I go to? And one of my questions I brought out from it was, or I came away thinking, was what are the responses of professionals? What do you see from different professions, from medical, social care, and authorities? What's your experience?
I suppose I work a lot with students, and I'm try and fit in at some point an opportunity to talk to them about this subject. And I get a mixed range there. But obviously with students, they've not got the life experience, perhaps they've not got the work experience. So you do get a lot of scepticism unless they've got personal experience.
Yeah.
With more experienced social workers, often there is a real understanding and a desire to help, but a crisis within social care and a feeling of, this actually isn't our job, this is somebody else's job. But no one quite knows whose job it is. And then of course different local authorities organise different ways, so you've got different configurations of teams, and so you can't just transfer. I can't just say, if someone contacts me and says, oh, I live so and so in the northeast of England, let's say, I can't just say, oh, well, the obvious place to go is there, because that might be a very different organisation to where I live. There are specialist people now offering a service, and I tried to map those, but I know already that some of those have closed because of the budget situation and because of austerity, which is really sad. And I would hope that we could reach a point where there's enough knowledge generally around the country that everybody, all frontline staff, would at least be aware of the issue, and that then would have a sense in their area. Maybe they don't have the knowledge and experience, but perhaps a duty social worker can refer someone to a local domestic violence agency, because in some parts of the country, that's who's offering the specialist knowledge.
Yeah.
Or they might say, or they might be able to offer a really thorough family assessment and actually say, yes, what actually your family needs at this moment is the child to be accommodated, and this is what we're going to do, and this is what we offer. And that was one of the issues that was coming up over the weekend, wasn't it? About when things get really, really, really scary and it's all too much, what do we do? Where do we go? And I've come across amazingly positive services, and I wrote about one back in January about an organisation that was offering a therapeutic care, and they'd got NVR built into the care they were offering in their residential. And they were very aware of what was doing. But I can't say to people, this is how you access this. And I hear from parents then, and of course it's the parents who are despairing that are often most vocal. I hear also when things have gone wrong, when young people have been accommodated and the parents' experience that is that there's been no help put in, and the child's young person's got worse and worse and worse because the people they've met.
Yeah.
And kind of that feels a very negative experience then. And so you would, if you knew that was that area, you wouldn't necessarily be wanting to say to another parent, oh, well, go there, you'll get help.
It's not a guarantee of anything, is it?
No.
I think often
again, from my own experience, that you lose control. Once you invite people in, you can potentially lose, you feel out of control and you need help. You're desperate, so you'll accept anything that you perhaps wouldn't normally accept. Mm. You mentioned NVR there, and I'm not looking for silver bullets, but what do you think of NVR? And I hear mixed responses. And that.
My understanding of NVR is that...
Sorry, I should say non-violent resistance. Which is...
My understanding is that the program that was originally developed has been adapted for families experiencing trauma, so is now more tailored to those situations. And I have spoken with families who've been through a program who found it really, really helpful.
Yeah.
I've also spoken with people who said, well, it kind of touched the edges, but it wasn't everything we needed. Yeah. And I think what I say to that is, first of all, that when a child is demonstrating violence, is being abusive, there are often more than one issue, and that actually you need to address the issues that are going on as well as the violence. And so to just practice and develop nonviolent resistance as a response is maybe going to touch the edges, but you need to address those other issues as well. So if the child has experienced trauma, then you need to be getting help with the trauma. If the child is behaving as they are because of domestic violence and family breakup, you need to be getting help to address living happily as a family post domestic violence. If a child has a physical illness or disability, then those issues need to be addressed. Perhaps they need a thorough physical examination. So it's about addressing all of the issues, not just looking at the violence and abuse, I guess.
Yeah, pinpointing specific
issues. But also, when I look at the different specialist responses that have been developed, they have many things in common.
Right.
And I've said to someone in the past, and felt I was about to be shot down, when you look at them on paper, they look, well, it's obvious, it's common sense, you know, do these things. That absolutely makes sense. And I wasn't quite shot down in flames, but they said, well, yes, but it's about how you do these things. And it's about attitude and understanding and the approach and the place that you're in as a parent and the place that the therapist is in, perhaps. So it's, I think, both of those issues, if you like, will mean that NVR sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, but it might help.
Yeah. I think there's a presumption of the person who's practicing NVR, they're in a safe place and they feel very calm and collected, and they're not there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of emphasis on you being able to maintain your own control, and that linked a little bit to what was hinted at. And I think this is probably one of the taboos of the whole issue, is that parents' response. And I mean, speaking from my own experience, I often have come away thinking, I can't believe I had to do that. And it was hinted at again. And I mentioned last podcast was that we had an experience where I kind of just reached the end of myself.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do anymore and felt that actually there's no one who can help. And so I wrote it all in a big blog, and and the blog exploded. People were it was like Frost Saturday and the Twitter thing, but times 10. And even now it's the blog that gets the most hits, because I think that desperation that I felt. And often coming away feeling, crikey, you know, did I have to sit on my daughter? Did I have to, you know, did I have to hold her so in a way, because I was fearful for myself, my other children and stuff. And so how do you find people when you have those conversations, and people must come to you a lot?
The whole issue of restraint is a huge one, isn't it? And but I really... it feels like, why are we having this discussion almost? You have to restrain a child if the child is putting themselves in danger. As a parent of my own children, if a child is about to run in the road, you grab them, you hold them
no
tight.
Question.
You know, what's the problem in that? And I've spoken with funnily enough, I was speaking just this morning with someone, and we were talking about their experiences of fostering a young person. Mm-hmm. And the fostering social worker said, I can give you an extra clothing allowance to acknowledge that you're damaging your clothes when you have to wrestle this girl to the ground, but that's all I can do. So
wow, that's a start, but it's
a start. It's not enough, but it's a start. But there's an acknowledgement this is going on, and that it's necessary. But I know from Twitter and from other places that there are some places that are some authorities that are really not happy with this. And I don't properly understand why. I can sort of intellectually work out reasons why they might be unhappy, but from a practice point of view, it just seems nonsensical. But obviously, parents feel very, you know, if you're being told not to do something and you have to, then that just adds to the complexity of the situation that you're in, and it really isn't helpful. And it demonstrates again, I suppose, still how much need there is to get word out there, to educate people, to help people, professionals, understand what's going on.
Because I think for foster carers, they obviously have a code of conduct, they have a contract, they have a whole set of policies. If a child reaches this point, no restraint, no physical contact is kind of the baseline. And I've been in situations with foster carers late on a night where a young boy wants to leave the house in pyjamas and the foster carer is stood at the front door. I can't stop this 8-year-old. Yeah. I can't stop him. I can't physically put my hands on a child who's putting themselves in harm. That's probably not a violence issue. It's more of a control issue. But I had an interesting conversation with the police because I thought, right, I'll go to the police. But mainly it started because of my own social worker, and I said, look, I have to restrain my daughter. You know, when she's trying to put my plate glass window out, I'm going to stop her.
Yeah.
So can you train me how to restrain my child? And she went, well, we don't believe in restraint. I said, well, yeah, but I don't believe in restraint, but I have to do it.
Yeah.
I said, so if I'm going to have to do it, would you train me so that I can do it in a way that doesn't, I'm going to keep her safe, keep myself safe?
Yeah.
No, because we don't believe in restraint. Go right, okay. I'll write a blog. So I spoke to the police, and it coincided with a few days. The police came to see us, and coincided a few days after where my daughter had come at me with a broom handle, and I invited her to stop in the nicest possible sense, ended up with me sat on her. But she'd been out horse riding, so she had a horse riding protection thing on, and so I was sat on her. Until she calmed down, or till I can't remember what happened. But the minute the policeman walked in, she said, "You'll never guess what he did. He did this, 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 this."
Yeah,
and the policeman just looked at her and went, "Sounds totally reasonable to me." And, and she just looked at him, and he just smiled and shrugged his shoulders, and that was it. And it actually was one of the turning points for us, where she saw that actually she couldn't take this further. So do you see that there are professionals out there who help? And,
I think you've touched on the police there, and I know that it's like with everything. Everybody's got their favourite professional, because in where they live, there's one person that's had some really fantastic training and gets it. And I speak to some people who say they won't touch the police, they won't go near the police because the police response is so awful. But there's other people who say they've saved my life.
Yeah.
And you mention responses like that, and you think that's – if you can have local officers like that who you can develop a relationship with, maybe if you're struggling, get to know your safer neighborhood police, get to know your local office.
And that was our decision.
Talk to them in advance, say, look, we think this is our problem, this is what might happen, this is how you can help us, so you don't get someone come out and say, don't do this again, or I'll come out again and tell you not to do it again, because that's all they can offer.
But it's that proactive approach.
Alternatively, you know, you find the parents being arrested, which is the other possibility which I've come across.
Yeah.
So if you can educate your local police, then great. And they can then become the first line of help for you. And or maybe you've got, you know, maybe you, within your circle of friends, there's a local police officer that you can use in those sorts of situations. Yeah. That's another possibility. So that can work. And there's a guy in Manchester who's in the police who's been doing a lot of research and is about to publish his PhD.
Right.
And I'm waiting to read that and to see, because that is about disseminating understanding within the police force. So that would be good.
Yeah, I mean, I found the police to be fantastic, but I think the key for me was that I went to them in a time of non-crisis.
Yeah.
And got to know the officer, and we had a lot of conversations on the phone about what was happening. Yeah. And we weren't at that moment of, you know, it wasn't a 999 call where police come in and perhaps have got a different set of priorities and different agenda. Yeah. It was he said, oh, well, I might be able to pop around. So that'd be great if you could pop around. And came around. Yeah. And it was a very interesting conversation. But we built up a really positive relationship. And, but what I did was into that, I used the names of my social worker and the names of my, you know, the different professionals who knew the environment.
Yeah.
And that kind of legitimized what I was saying. It wasn't just me saying my daughter's this and I'm a this and whatever. So that was good. I was looking at, and I don't want to paint stereotypes because I'm a trained social worker, so that gets squeezed out of me. Stereotypes squeeze it out of me.
Heaven forbid.
I was thinking about the different, do you hear predominantly from women or men? Do you get, what are the different responses, the different reactions?
I'm hearing mostly from women, almost exclusively I'm hearing from women. That's possibly because I'm sort of looking at it often as a friend situation.
Right.
But the men are perhaps less ready to talk about it or less comfortable talking about it. The research suggests that that in two parent families, particularly, well, if you're in two parent families where there is a man, then there is likelihood that the man figure in the household will also be being assaulted or abused in some way. So it's suggestive looking at the figures and the roots, if you like, that women are going to be getting it disproportionately.
Right.
And that's partly because there's a lot of single parent families where there's been domestic violence or there's been a breakup in the relationship and the woman's now living on their own with the children. And that feeds quite highly. So, for instance, the research that Ed Gallagher in Australia did, who I mentioned earlier, he's worked with hundreds and hundreds of families, and he reckons probably in about half the cases it would be a single parent where the son is abusing the mother.
Right.
Post-domestic violence. But it's not a straightforward causal thing, it's a correlation.
But
for that sort of reason, that jigs the figures, obviously.
Yeah.
But it does feel generally as though it's quite gendered in that it's more young men, more boys than young men, and more mothers that are receiving end.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about in adoption and the fostering community, do you see similar correlation that it's predominantly women you're speaking to?
I think you are the better position to answer that because it's one of those things on Twitter. No, it's one of those things on Twitter, isn't it? You think you're getting a representative sample, but you're only listening to the people that you're following.
Yeah.
And there's hundreds of other people that are tweeting that I don't have any connection with and I don't know anything about what their experiences are. So,
yeah, I mean, I think within the adoption community, that sort of Twitter or social media world, it's predominantly women who are on. And I don't know whether that's the nature of men or the nature of women or a little bit of terrified of falling into a stereotype. Almost can't speak. But I just wonder whether what difference do you think it impact? What is the impact on a man versus a woman? I've got my thoughts, but I'm interested in yours.
There's very little research done on it, but what there is suggests that men, it's a huge, there are complex issues. One is about it feels very difficult because you don't know how to respond physically. Yeah. The restraint thing about what are you going to be accused of, about your, and there's the whole thing about your manliness is being undermined. So there's that kind of emotional stuff going on. Your role is to protect your family, if you like. Yeah. You know, so for a woman who's very much wound up in this is my job, this is my life, I've brought this child into the world, my role is to care for them and nurture them. Mm-hmm. And to have that, then all the stuff that goes with that when the child starts abusing you, that all the shame and all the guilt and all the blame that people pour on you. And then for a man, you've got something similar and parallel, but you've also got the role as a protector and not been able to fulfill that. So we're back to stereotypes. A lot of it, I think, is about how the roles that society gives different people, which are deeply, deeply ingrained and are stereotypes because they're based on a grain of truth, aren't they?
Yes.
We still organise our society very much in this way. And those are the things. So I think for men as well, there is a problem about not being able to protect the woman in the relationship, a wife, a partner, how that feels. And then you've got all the stuff about, I can't talk about my feelings.
I don't talk about my feelings.
Whereas women are perhaps more able to go find a friend and talk to a friend and really open up and have a good cry and get some help in that way. So I think men are affected in different ways. And
yeah. I mean, sometimes I don't get a lot of contact from men in relation to this. But it is interesting that they feel it's very complicated, and it is very complicated. Yeah. I remember spending nights when we used to fight through the night, which is a sentence I never thought I'd say. I remember it would be hours and hours of really difficult interactions and physical, trying to stop things happening, and thinking it became quite dark,
That
sense of, I think at the very beginning you said it's not just a one-off event, it's a series of events, and you change your behaviour. And I started to feel quite concerned about the things I was thinking. Feeling, actually, I could resolve this. I feel like, especially with a small child, I think I could just become this monster that would terrify a child into doing what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that was... That was, I think, when I kind of went, whoa, this has gone too far. It was before I was a social worker, I had to leave work in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that becomes really complex, and people are with that isolation. And you see people, I mean, I don't want to kind of, we could go down the wormhole and just into this world of unhappiness and pain and anxiety. But do you see positive stories? Tell me some good stories.
Okay, well, I see, I speak to people who have had the most amazing CAMS worker ever who still keeps in touch even though they've left work, totally unprofessional. But
I'll edit that bit out.
Couldn't possibly talk
about
it. Don't
name any names.
But even then, you've got people, the parents saying, this still goes on, but I've learned how to cope with it. I've learned how to manage it. I've learned how to keep safe. I've got a really good circle of friends around me who I can call on a moment's notice. My family are involved. They know how to deal with this. They can give me a break. So people who have found a way through and have come out the other end.
Mm-hmm.
People who have other people where they've somehow lived through it with gritted teeth and shell-shocked have come out the other end. And the kid's kind of grown out of it. And
right.
They've kind of, it's almost like they've worked out all their anger and their frustration, and they've reached a kind of point of almost exhaustion, but they kind of picked themselves up and are now starting over and have made relationship work.
Mm-hmm.
People who've gone through specialist programs.
Right.
Programs like Who's in Charge, which is a program just for parents.
Right.
And then other programs like Step Up or Break the Change, which are directed at they work in parallel with the young person and the parents, and there's some coming together. And those sorts of programs, which might last anything between 8-12 weeks, they have now got a reasonable amount of figures and data, and they can look at them and say, yes, for most families there is a significant improvement. It doesn't mean that the violence is finished, but the families have reached a point where it's manageable and they can live with it and they can get on with their lives now, and they've got a sufficient support network around them that they can get on and cope with things.
So is there links on your website to these different courses or who provides those, them?
So I that's part of the map, which is, right, as I say, out of date, where people can access those. Now, I would be interested to hear from people with within the adoption community, where you've got children who've experienced really extreme trauma, whether those things will work for you. And I don't know whether they, because I think we're getting back to the issue of you need to address the underlying issue.
Yeah.
These programs, and some of them will say we only work with birth families because they recognise that. So I think they are offer parents a way of building their self-esteem, building their support network, understanding what's going on within the relationship, because it will be identifying this issue as a relationship issue. It's not something that's rooted in the child. It's not a bad child. It's not a bad parent. It's a relationship issue which needs support and understanding and solution. So there is, but it's looking at the violence and it's looking at what's behind that, and it's looking at developing different ways of interacting and supporting that. So I think there is still a need to address all those other issues as well, but these programs seem to be quite successful. I also speak to individual counsellors and therapists who are saying they're offering one-to-one support, right, which is kind of doing the same thing. And we are kind of back to, if you look at all of this stuff on paper, it's not rocket science.
No, that's the truth, unfortunately.
But it's about parents need support because they've reached such a point where, you know, if you're lying on the floor, you can't suddenly go from 0 to 10 without support. You need you need help to understand what's going on, to step back, to look at different ways of doing things, to put into play different strategies.
I think one thing that we found helpful was just knowing that people were available. Yeah. So we spoke to Amanda Borman at the Open Nest.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was just someone who was listening and wasn't.
Yeah.
And someone who was able to kind of help us make sense of what is the right decision when, you know,
yeah,
a child is trying to destroy something. And she said, well, let's see, what you're doing is right. It's the right thing.
Yeah.
And that led us to, I feel sorry for my post-adoption support service because I'm a pain in their flesh. I'd never get in touch, but when I do, I'm really quite clear. So I said, look, I really like supervision. I'd like someone to tell this stuff too. And they went, well, we can't give you that service. I said, well, I tell you what, I don't even want an answer necessarily. I just want to tell you. So can I email it to you? And then it's on record if things go wrong. It's on record. You just put it in my case files. I don't even want you to get back to me. But can I just tell you? So, and there was a period where every couple of months I'd write an email saying this happened and that happened and I did this and she did that and it was very bad, and then we were all okay in the end. And that worked well. There was some challenges in that, but that worked really well and it felt like it got off my chest.
There's something I think, sorry to interrupt you, I think there's something about writing stuff down as well, because it's a cathartic process often, but you see, once you start writing things down or perhaps telling somebody else, you start to make connections, you start to see things that maybe you didn't see before. Yeah. I don't know if that's something that you found that actually it made more sense in a different way when you did.
I think Paula does write things down in a sort of a diary sense for herself. But it kind of makes sense that you've built this story that you can tell people, and you can say, well, actually, look at my story. Look at this.
Yeah.
This is not an angry child who just lost their temper. This is more than that. There's a whole narrative and a journey that we've been on here. And that helps, you know, if you do need to involve people like the police, you can say, well, actually, look, this is our average month, this is our average week, this is our average day.
Yeah.
And people go, whoa, you've reframed that for me and you've got evidence. So it's been interesting. I found NVR was part of our solution.
Yeah.
It wasn't the solution. It was just another thing to have in the know, parenting.
A toolbox, yeah.
Utility belt, yeah. And we, I mean, on a positive note, we have seen a huge reduction.
Yeah, that's encouraging, yeah.
It is, but I think the key thing was that we've learned how to manage it, because I don't think we've changed anything. I think we've learned when to walk away.
Yeah.
And we've had the odd stress ball broken, but I'd much rather have a broken stress ball than a
But that's interesting window. That you say about walking away, because I think we can get really caught up in I have to be in charge, I'm the parent.
Yeah.
I need to show that I'm in charge, that I'm responsible, and I've got to resolve this. And actually, sometimes it is about just walking away and feeling comfortable to do that and feeling safe to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I've reframed a lot of our interactions to make sense that I walk away and I think, well, I've taken control of the environment because I've walked away.
Yeah.
And that makes sense to me as a man, kind of a, not being stereotypical, but I thought, well, actually, I won this because I know where we were going and we're not there.
I don't have to have the last word.
In my head, I've got the last word. I'll go in when she's asleep and whisper the last word. Because I am pedantic, if nothing else, and childish. That's terrible. I shouldn't admit to that.
We'll edit that bit out.
Yeah, we'll definitely cut that bit out. I don't really want to take up too much more of your time. I mean, I think we could probably return to this every week for the next 25 years and still find something fresh. But
is there other things that I'm flicking my eyes at the list of things that I wrote? And I mean, what you do in the actual situation is a big one, isn't it? Was one of the things that came up and about early help. So what do you do in that situation? What do you do in this situation? And I think that's where if you've got the advice early on, then that you've got some tools in your utility belt. You might be able to restrain. And you might, as you say, you might have to just walk away. But every situation is different, isn't it? I can't say this is what you do in that situation. It might be important that you take all the other children and lock yourself in the bedroom because that's the safest thing to do.
Yeah.
It might be that you leave the house. It might be that you sit on a child. It might be that you call 999.
And you know your child and you know your built environment as well, don't you? You know your house. You know where a safe place is. If you don't want to get cornered or all of those things, I think it's doing what you have to do in that moment. And that was another question I think people were saying, and it was probably linked into the NVR around.
Yeah.
NVR is all well and good, but if this child A is hitting child B, then that's not child parent violence, but it's still violence.
It's violence within the family, isn't it? And it's. And you've got a much clearer, I think that's when social workers start getting jittery as well, isn't it? When you've got another child clearly at risk.
It murkies the waters, doesn't it?
Yes.
Considerably.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I have any more questions. I mean, I have lots of questions and I think I could talk to you forever, but I don't want to take up all of your time. I appreciate you've spoken to me today. Is there anything people can do? Do you like people to get in touch with you, email your account? Is there anything for your website that we can help you with as a community?
Yeah. Well, what I try and post something every 1 or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And sometimes there'll be a month when I've got masses of stuff, either new research published or stuff in the news that I can kind of riff off, if you like. And then they'll get a really quiet spell. What I really value is if people want to tell their story or if people have read something that there's obviously a theme about child parent violence and abuse rather than specifically adoption. But if someone has got a story that they would like to tell, I'm very happy to publish that.
Right.
It's great if people use it as a conversation. Quite often I'll post something and then people will start a conversation around that. Sometimes people respond on Twitter and I think, respond on the website.
Yeah, I get that as well. I love comments on the website. It makes me feel like a grown-up.
It makes you feel like someone's listening rather than just posting out into the ether. But also because I hope that the website will be a resource for everybody, for professionals, for academics, for parents perhaps. The more comments and the more input there is, the better. Mm-hmm. So then if people know about training courses that I can, or they're running something and they want me to publicise that,
I'll vet it before I put it up.
Yeah.
Because I need to be, I've obviously got to check what I'm putting up and advertising, but I'm really happy to publicise things like that. If people find a book or research that they want to have wider reach, then I'm always looking for stuff to increase on there. But yeah, I'm happy for people to contact me, but what I can't do is I can't offer individual counselling. I can sometimes say to someone, well, oh, okay, you live in the Midlands, well, this organisation.
Well, I think just your little breadth of experience and the depth of experience is really beneficial. Mm. And I know that we, in some ways, from the adoption perspective, we bring our own little unique elements to that. But we're not that unique. And there's not that many of us. So, you know, that's fair enough. Fostering is a bit bigger. But I think generally it's an issue that I never heard of. I'd never heard of at all.
Yeah.
And
people still haven't. And people, friends still get confused what I'm talking about and still assume I'm talking about something else completely different.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, so keep the faith and fight the good fight. And Michelle, thank you very much for having a chat to me.
Well, it's been lovely to speak, and I look forward perhaps to more in the future. Thank you.
That'll be wonderful. Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Helen, and I came away wanting to know so much more. And listening back to it there, I kind of thought, actually, I've got so many more questions, and Helen has such a depth and a breadth of knowledge and has drawn on the experiences of so many people from, you know, different types of families, different types of experiences, that she's someone who has an awful lot to offer people. I'd hope that people would visit her website, which is theholeinthewall.co.uk. And if they want to contribute to the website and perhaps post their own experiences to add into that library and that central point for knowledge. Clearly, I think it's a developing field. I think that it's an area that a lot of adopters are quite shocked by, that actually they walk into this life and that this was not part of the deal and this was not on the radar. And I know for myself that actually it was never even mentioned or even considered prior to it developing and unfolding in our own lives. So I think without doubt we'll be coming back to that, and I think that I'm going to blog about that this week and really just get some more information, and hopefully people can add into all of that, and we'll maybe get some more experts, we'll find some more people who know some stuff, and maybe talk a bit further about NVR and various other systems and models and ways of managing child-parent violence. So thank you very much. I hope you all have a great week. And I'm going to sit here in the car and listen to the sound of rain on the windscreen. Oh, that was a bit creepy, wasn't it?